Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for tuning in, and welcome back. Today we will explore photography that's out of this world. We'll begin with astrophotographer Dr. Robert Gendler, and then talk to some of the people who made his telescopes from RC Optical Systems, Brad Ehrhorn and Kyle Sturzenbecker. Let's begin with our astrophotographer, Dr. Robert Gendler. Now, every week I post some images on my website, and some of you are able to look at them and some aren't. Perhaps you're listening to the show in your car on the way to work. But this week, the whole show is about images. So whatever it takes, make sure that when you get home, you go to the website and look at Dr. Gendler's images. The website, again, is guidetothecosmos.com. Click on the microphone icon. That'll bring up a menu of radio shows. And click on today's show, Photography That's Out of This World with Dr. Robert Gendler. Dr. Gendler is a physician who is an amateur photographer, and he has earned an international acclaim for his photography. Known to his astronomy friends as Rob, Rob was featured in the PBS television documentary Seeing in the Dark by Timothy Ferris. Dr. Ferris called Gendler one of the greatest astrophotographers in all of history. Now, as you know, we live in a society where hyperbole is the norm, but if you're questioning whether or not that statement can really be true, then just take a look at these images. These are some of the most spectacular images ever seen, including images taken by professional photographers on the world's greatest telescopes. Rob's images have appeared regularly in Sky and Telescope magazine and in Astronomy magazine, and also on the NASA website, Astronomy Picture of the Day. He's the author of two great books, A Year in the Life of the Universe and Capturing the Stars, Astrophotography by the Masters. Over 400 of Rob's images are published in books and magazines devoted to astronomy, including 40 that were the cover of the magazines and books. So, Rob, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
We want to go through some of these spectacular images that are on your website. Your website is robgendlerastropics.com. Astropics is spelled A-S-T-R-O-P-I-C-S, astropics.com. And the first image that I like to look at is one of my favorites, and that's the Andromeda Galaxy, otherwise known as M31. Rob, could you tell us something about this spectacular image?
Well, that image was a great deal of work. It took me probably about 4 months to construct the image. It took about 3 months of imaging, many sessions. The image is it's a mosaic, so it's not a single frame. It's actually about 40 frames that are stitched together using image processing software.
So, and let's see if I understand what a mosaic is. So you take an image of a small piece of the galaxy, and then after you're done with that, you take an image of the adjacent piece and so forth until you've covered sort of like a chessboard, all the different squares.
Exactly.
And yeah. Then you put them together somehow, huh?
Right, right. It may sound easier than it is. It's actually a very challenging kind of project because the sky is really, it looks two-dimensional, but it's three-dimensional, and there's really more of a sphere. The camera chip records the frame in a rectangle, but actually there's some spatial distortion in between frames, and when you get out to, 30 or 40 frames, there's quite a lot of rotation and distortion, and it takes a lot of correction to get the frames to not only fit together, but also to match in color and contrast. And so it's probably an equal amount of time spent on the computer assembling the mosaic as it is to actually acquire the frame. So a project like that is really a great deal of work. But I was pleased with the result.
Oh, it's a spectacular picture.
Thank you.
I think it says on your website that it took 90 hours of telescope time to gather all the photons that are shown in this image.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that it's the largest CCD image of a spiral galaxy that's ever been taken. It has 1 billion pixels of data in this one image.
Right. At the time, right, I guess that was 2005, yeah. I'm not sure if anyone has produced something larger. But it was an interesting story that goes along with this. A few months after I produced the image, the Hubble Space Telescope came out with a mosaic of a different galaxy, M101, another nice spiral in the northern sky. And their press release stated that this was the largest image in pixel dimensions ever taken of a spiral galaxy. And one of the editors at Sky and Telescope magazine contacted me and said, you know, Rob, they're making this statement in their press release, but I've seen your image, and I know that your image is substantially larger, and I think they really need to know this. So they gave the editor permission. He contacted the team at the Hubble Telescope, and they had to change their press release. and they put a little footnote, mentioning my image.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what makes Andromeda such a special object in the sky?
I think Andromeda is it's a really unique opportunity for not only astronomical photographers, but astronomical observers. You know, here we have an enormous spiral galaxy, equal in size to our Milky Way, that's relatively close. I mean, when I say close, it's close by astronomical standards. It's 2.4 million light years away. I mean, even though that is a huge distance, but intergalactic standards, it's really our close neighbor. The Andromeda galaxy is tilted, I think, about 15 degrees, so it presents a tremendous amount of detail. It's really a favorite of astronomical photographers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, and it's also a great opportunity for research. You know, professional astronomers have this huge spiral galaxy slightly tilted towards our line of sight, and there's a tremendous amount of data and information that we can get from Andromeda. Andromeda is also considered like a sibling of the Milky Way. It was probably formed from the same ancestral beginnings and are actually traveling towards each other. And it's been hypothesized that the two galaxies will eventually merge long after our lifetimes, maybe a billion or 2 billion years from now, to form a single galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a special object in the sky.
Isn't it also the first galaxy that was identified as a separate galaxy from the Milky Way by Edwin Hubble?
Yes. Edwin Hubble, he identified individual stars using, I think it was the 100-inch Hooker telescope at Mount Wilson. And that was really the birth of cosmology. You know, it was the beginning of our understanding that we are not the only galaxy in the universe, that there are not just several other galaxies, but literally billions or even hundreds of billions of galaxies similar to our own. It's really the birth of modern cosmology. So it has a lot of historical significance as well.
Now, you took this picture with a digital camera, which mm-hmm. has a electronic device as its retina that's referred to as a CCD.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who take digital pictures of our grandchildren and so forth with digital cameras are familiar in a sense with using CCD images, but CCDs are a relatively new invention. In fact,
right.
The two inventors of the CCD system just won the Nobel Prize in Physics this year.
And
could you comment about the comparison of taking images, astrophotography, with CCD versus film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are several great advantages to CCD. The first advantage in regards to astronomical imaging is that CCDs are far more sensitive to low levels of light than film. For decades, astronomical photography was done with film. Film is sensitive to normal levels of light, but it's relatively insensitive, very low levels of light. And when we're doing astronomical photography of these deep space objects, these galaxies that are millions of light years away, we're dealing with extremely low levels of light, so we need a sensitive detector. But in, I think it was 1969, it was Boyle and Smith, right? They're the inventors of the CCD. they came out with this CCD, this electronic detector, that is many times more sensitive than film, and it offered a huge advantage, especially for astronomical photography. It takes much less time to record these very faint objects that are far away. The other great advantage of CCD is that it generates a primary digital image. Film images can be digitized, but they need to be scanned, and information is usually lost every time you transfer the data. CCD generates a digital image, which then can be manipulated further using image processing software, so image data can be amplified. Colors that are extremely faint can be amplified to have a much stronger quality and be much more visible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it was a tremendous revolution in not only in astrophotography, but in traditional daylight photography as well.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine it would be a real nightmare to try to stitch together a mosaic of, what did you say, 40 or 50 images that were on film to begin with.
Well, once you digitize the images, you could splice them together. But again, film images are very insensitive.
And you took that image at your observatory in New Mexico called Nighthawk.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an image on the website, image number 2, of your telescope, which I guess has a 20-inch main mirror?
Yes, yes. That was the telescope I used from 2005 to 2007.
Mm-hmm.
After 2007, I moved my equipment to a different observatory in the southern hemisphere in Western Australia. That observatory is also managed and run by the same people who run the New Mexico Observatory. It's Mike and Lynn Rice.
Does that mean, Rob, that when you want to take one of your pictures, you have to go to Australia?
Not really, no. The other amazing revolution in astronomical photography is the ability to do remote imaging. Remote meaning controlling an observatory that may be on 1,000, 2,000 miles, or on the other side of the planet, controlling it using the Internet. This was not really possible at an amateur level 10 years ago, but the software and the hardware involved become so sophisticated and relatively, I wouldn't say inexpensive, but a lot less expensive than it was, so that there are many amateurs today who are doing remote imaging. So the benefit of that is that you can have your telescope equipment under very dark skies. You could be living in a city with a lot of light pollution, but yet be doing astrophotography from, very dark sky location, which would give you much higher quality image data.
So you can stay at your house in Connecticut and you can run your telescope in Australia.
Yeah.
And take the images that you want all by remote control. What a really miracle that is. That means you can even do it in the daytime, right?
Yes. It actually works out very nicely for me because the difference in time is 12 hours. So I get up in the morning before I go to work. I program in a automated script which allows me to do the imaging unattended over the course of several hours, and then I go to work, and then when I come home, the image data is then downloaded from the computer in Australia to my desktop computer here at home, and then I can process the data and make the image.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, some people that may be listening may be totally unfamiliar with astrophotography.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things about taking pictures of the heavens, of course, is that the Earth rotates.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to take a long exposure of anything in the sky, the telescope has to track that object as the Earth rotates. Mm-hmm. So your telescope, I presume, contains some sort of an automated system to track objects in the sky. Does that work as well as I've described it, or is there more of a trick to it than that?
No, that's pretty much the basic concept. There's what's called a clock drive in the mount. The telescope sits on top of a mount, which has the ability to rotate in a very precise way. And what it does is it has the telescope moving counter to the Earth's rotation so that the object you're imaging stays exactly in the center of either the eyepiece or the camera.
And just to give people a feeling for what kind of investment goes into having a telescope like that with a CCD imaging system and remote control, could you put a ballpark figure on the cost?
Well, it all depends on the size of the telescope. I would say that there is a big range, but probably at least the price of a fairly mid-level car, I would say, that kind of investment could would be necessary to do serious, you know, serious astrophotography.
So a BMW, but not a Maserati.
Right. Okay. You could go to the Maserati level, but, you know, if you wanted. But
okay.
Yeah.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and today we are talking about photography that's out of this world with Dr. Robert Gendler. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back talking about photography that's out of this world with Dr. Robert Gendler. Image number three is the Vela supernova remnant, and you took this from your, when you relocated your telescope to Australia, I guess.
Yes.
And this is a massive star that came to the end of its life and exploded in a spectacular supernova, which astronomers estimated happened 11 or 12,000 years ago. And we are seeing the remnant, the outer layers of the star that were blown off into space. And the core of the star collapsed into something called a neutron star, which is actually rotating extremely rapidly. So tell us about this this particular image.
Well, this image, it's just a fantastic field. It's full of a range of different object types. The field contains not only the supernova remnant, but also different emission nebulae, clouds of gas that are, you know, emitting energy from adjacent stars. So it has and it also has some beautiful field stars as well. So it has a really beautiful variety of different object types. The image was inspired by an image taken by David Martin, who published an image of similar field using plates from the UK Schmidt camera. And I really fell in love with this field and everything it had to offer photographically, and decided to repeat the image that he did, but expand the field of view and to do it in natural color as well, to do it in RGB color. So it was a project I was really excited about, and it came together pretty nicely.
It's a spectacular image. And again, this one has over 60 hours of telescope time.
Right. You know, one fascinating thing about supernova remnants is that supernovas release elements that are present in living things that were either made during the supernova event or were released by the supernova event. So elements like oxygen and carbon and the iron in our hemoglobin, in our blood, we owe that to supernovas. So supernovas replenish the interstellar medium with these heavier elements that become the building blocks of life. So in a way, we really owe our existence to not only stars, but these massive stars that have exploded in supernova blasts.
So it's fair to say that we are made of stardust.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there's the creation of stardust right in front of us in that image.
That's right.
So astronomy is not just about taking beautiful pictures, but is about understanding our universe as well. Let's take a look at your next image, which is of the Helix Nebula. So this is the result of another exploding star, isn't it?
Well, it's not an exploding star. It is an object formed from a dying star. Stars end their lives in different ways depending on their mass. The stars that explode in huge supernova blasts are the most massive stars. They have a critical mass that once it's exceeded, the star then goes into a cycle which results in a supernova. The stars of lesser mass, the intermediate and small mass stars, which our sun is one of those stars, end their lives by actually collapsing down into something called a white dwarf, which is a very dense, small object. And the outer layers of the dying star get ejected into space, and those layers form beautiful shapes and emit brilliant colors and just outstanding. They're called actually planetary nebulae, not because they have anything to do with planets, but they're usually round, and early observers thought they were planets, so that name kind of stuck. Mm-hmm. So this is a planetary nebula. It's a nebula formed from the contents of a dying star. What's interesting about this is really the fate of our own sun, because the star in the center, which formed this nebula, is about the same mass as our sun. So our sun is about halfway through its life, and maybe in another 4 or 5 billion years, we'll form an object similar to this.
Mm-hmm. And how did you take this image?
Well, I had a great opportunity came up to process image data taken by a professional telescope in Chile. This is taken by the Danish telescope at the European Southern Observatory in La Silla, Chile. And they asked me to process some of this image data to use for educational purposes. This is actually a professional telescope image processed by me. And this is it was just an opportunity that was so much fun and so exciting to have this kind of data that really you could not record with an amateur-level instrument.
Right. So this is the 1.5-meter telescope at La Silla, Chile?
Right, right.
So that's about 5 feet across.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Fantastic. And let's look now at M42. So this is the Great Orion Nebula. And this, again, is 90 hours of telescope time for this spectacular image. And that was taken by your telescope in New Mexico, is that right?
Yes.
So tell us what's exciting about this picture, other than the fact that it's spectacular and beautiful.
Orion is similar to the Andromeda Galaxy in that it's a real favorite of astrophotographers. Again, it's an object that's within our galaxy, so it's actually much closer than Andromeda. It's about 1,500 light-years away. And Orion is just really one of the showpieces of the night sky. It has brilliant colors, incredible depth and form to it, so it's just tremendously exciting to image this object. What's special about Orion is that it's a stellar nursery. Stars are actively forming within the Orion Nebula. Actually, thousands of infant stars are embedded in the gases and dust of the Orion Nebula. Another interesting fact is that at the center, all the light that you see coming from the Orion Nebula is really from a single star, which is, I always found amazing. There's a small collection of stars at the very core, the very brightest part of Orion called the trapezium. So there are four bright stars there. All of the illuminating energy that you see coming from Orion comes from the brightest of those four stars called Theta Orionis. Theta Orionis exceeds our sun's brightness by 250,000 times, something like that. It's a quarter of a million times brighter than our own sun. If the Earth was situated near Theta Orionis, we'd probably be in perpetual daytime, if the Earth could survive at all next to such a hot star. Really a tremendously energetic star and really energizes and illuminates our nebula complex, which is about 40 light years from end to end.
Well, 250,000 times the luminosity of the sun. I mean, that's as if we were 500 times closer to our own sun.
Right.
Which is well within the orbit of Mercury. So we would need to be under layers of lead or something to protect ourselves from something that bright.
It would be a very hot world, yeah. Yes.
And that's a star which has a mass that's about 40 times the mass of our own sun.
Yes. It's in the category of supergiant stars. Will likely end its life in a supernova event. Nobody knows when, maybe in a million years or so.
Yeah, such stars usually don't live more than a few million years, so it must be, relatively speaking, happening sometime soon.
Mm-hmm.
astronomically speaking.
Correct.
And the last image I want to look at is the spectacular Horsehead Nebula. And this one you took with 9 hours of telescope time. And I didn't write down what telescope you took this with. Is this, again, your 20-inch?
Now, this is the wide-field image you have displayed?
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this was actually taken, from my driveway back in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
The Horsehead Nebula is, again, another favorite of astrophotographers. It's an extremely aesthetic field. It has a variety of different object types, from the Horsehead itself, which is a light year long column of dust that just fortuitously shaped itself into what looks like a horse's head.
Right. And for those that aren't familiar with light years, that's about 6 trillion miles. So that's an object which is 1,000 times bigger than our own solar system?
Maybe more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, within the Horsehead itself are infant stars that are forming from the material in that object, dust that collapsing and contracting under gravity and will form stars for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
Within that field, there are other spectacular clouds such as the Flame Nebula, which is a big flame-shaped cloud of glowing gases. Within the Flame Nebula, there are hundreds or possibly thousands of infant stars that are formed from the gas and dust within the Flame Nebula.
That's the bright object on the lower left?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Aesthetically speaking, the Zeta Orionis, which is the bright star on the left side of the image, creates a beautiful focal point to direct the eye. Zeta Orionis is actually one of the 3 belt stars of Orion. When we look up at the constellation Orion in the midwinter, actually right around now, if we go outside at night and we see the 3 belt stars,
mm-hmm.
Zeta Orionis is one of those belt stars. And the Horsehead, you can use your imagination when you look up at the sky, the Horsehead is just adjacent to Zeta Orionis.
Great. Mm. Now, Rob, you didn't start out in astrophotography by buying a telescope that costs as much as a BMW, did you?
No.
So how would you recommend that someone who is just starting out might approach that?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the best recommendations that I can have for someone who has an interest or thinks they have an interest in astronomy, or if they have a child who's interested in astronomy, is to look up your local astronomy club. And there are many astronomy clubs all over the country. And most astronomy clubs have events, or they may call them star parties, where maybe once a month they have members bring out their telescopes, and the public is usually invited to look through their telescopes, and they can see a variety of objects. And this is a great way to kind of get acquainted with the night sky, to get educated, because usually the members of these clubs are very knowledgeable and answer a lot of questions and explain a lot of things. I would kind of discourage people about going to department stores. You know, the holidays are coming up now, and people might be tempted to buy a department store telescope. I think that most of those wind up in the closet or the attic after 1 or 2 attempts to use them. Your time would be better spent hooking up with a local club and looking through some really good telescopes and being around people who can teach you the night sky.
Mm-hmm. You began your career in astrophotography actually with a pair of binoculars, didn't you?
Yes. I'd been interested in astronomy since I was very young, but I grew up in New York City, so my interest was really stayed within the books and the planetarium experience. I did not have a telescope, but later in life, moved out to central Connecticut. The skies were much darker, and my first attempt to learn the night sky was simply with a pair of binoculars, and binoculars are a great instrument. There's many deep sky objects that you can see with a pair of binoculars, star clusters, even galaxies. You can see the Andromeda Galaxy with a pair of binoculars. Binoculars also can be used during the daytime for terrestrial enjoyment. So I think that a pair of binoculars is actually an excellent investment, and I would suggest starting out with that rather than a department store telescope.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So again, for our listeners, you can see all of these images plus hundreds of others on Rob's website, which is robgendlerastropix.com, or you can go to my website, guidetothecosmos.com, and there'll be a link to Rob's website. And you also sell some of these images, don't you, Rob?
Yes. If people are interested in prints, I think astrophotography has become a real art form, comparable to all, many other forms of photographic art. And so I sell prints of my images, and people can contact me or contact the vendors from my website.
My wife is an underwater photographer, and she is absolutely captivated by the images that she saw on your website, and she tells me that some of them are extremely modestly priced, in the range of, let's say, $25. So people can really enjoy some of these fantastic images at much less than the cost of a BMW. Rob, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And again, the listeners can go to Rob's website, robgendlerastropix.com, or find his website on my website, guidetothecosmos.com. Now I'd like to welcome from RC Optical Systems, Brad Ehrhorn, who's the Vice President of Engineering and Chief Designer of these telescopes, and Kyle Sturzenbecker, who's the Director of Sales. RC Optical Systems is the company that supplied the telescope that we saw the gorgeous pictures taken by Rob Gendler. So, Brad, would you like to tell us something about what makes this such a wonderful telescope?
Well, actually, that's only part true what you just mentioned about Rob. He actually has two of our telescopes.
I see.
These particular telescopes are designed really for professional use, and Rob's skills certainly deserve that. So they employ a type of optical system that's called a Ritchey-Chrétien, which is a two-mirror system and is color-free, coma-free. It has the largest aberration-free field of view of any reflecting telescope made. Definitely considered top of the line for amateur astronomers and professional astronomers. We also use a carbon truss type of construction. We use low expansion materials wherever we can because, as most astronomers will tell you, the temperature changes greatly during the night. And every time the temperature drops with telescopes that are unstable thermally, they have to refocus. So our telescopes generally stay in focus all night long, and the photographer doesn't have to worry about refocusing every half hour or every 15 minutes, depending on temperature drop.
Oh, I see. And yet the telescope has to be very strong to hold all of these assemblies in place with a very high precision.
It actually sounds really simple. A telescope just has to hold two mirrors. That's it. But to do that to the precision level that we expect here at RC Optical Systems, a lot of engineering goes into that so that the telescope's optics perform at their best possible level. These are high-end telescopes. Our company philosophy from the very beginning was to make the highest performing system that we could do. It's basically a no-compromise system. That's the foundation of our company, and that's what we do. Unfortunately, there is a cost associated with that. Just the optics are very expensive. The type of prescription that a Ritchey-Chrétien is actually very hard to make. We also only use zero-expansion ceramic substrates such as astrocytol or Zerodur or ULE. Same thing for the focus stability. So everything we do is we choose the highest performing materials possible, and like I said, there unfortunately is a cost associated with it.
And what's the largest aperture telescope that you make?
The largest that we've made so far is a 34-inch or a 0.86 meter, which is being used by the Air Force for a tracking mount.
And what is the smallest telescope that you make?
We've made, actually, another Air Force telescope. That's an 8-inch aperture, and that telescope will actually be in space here as soon as it's delivered later this year.
And do all the telescopes use the same basic mirror design?
Generally, yes. We you know, we specialize in Ritchie Chrétien optics, but we've made multiple other types of optical designs as well, including classical Cassegrains, Dahl-Kirkhams, Mersennes, things like that. So, you know, we're customer-driven. So whatever our customers ask, that's what we try to do.
And how long have you been making telescopes, Brad?
For about 17 years now.
What are the important things to look for in a high-end telescope?
You basically want to make sure that you're getting the real deal as far as optics. Very few manufacturers actually test their optics. So if you were to buy a typical telescope, even a high-end telescope from most manufacturers, and they'll give you an optical specification saying that the optics are diffraction limited, but they don't offer any supporting interferometry or testing to prove that they are. So when you're buying optics from somebody or a telescope with optics, you really want to make sure that you're getting what you're paying for.
Mm-hmm.
You basically set up the optics on a test bench and measure the interference patterns coming back out of the telescope. And by doing the interferometry, you can determine if the optics are 1/20th wave RMS or if they're 5 waves RMS. You can see all the optical aberrations, but very, very few places actually do interferometry on their optics.
I see. That's very interesting. Brad, is there anything that you'd like to say on behalf of your company?
It's always a pleasure working with our customers, and they do all the hard work. We get to have all the fun making the telescopes, and I'm always very impressed and proud of what our customers are doing.
Are you an astronomer yourself?
I am.
Brad and Kyle, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. It was a pleasure, and maybe we'll get back and do this again sometime.
Very good. Well, thanks for talking with us.
So thank you for tuning in, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.